Aloha, mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. Happy Monday, it's July 13th. I'm Robbie Dingman, in for Catherine Cruz. We hear from the state's chief elections officer. Federal officials are threatening prosecution if Hawaii allows non-citizens to vote. Why the elections chief says that's not an issue. We get an update on the community of homeless people living near the Waianae Boat Harbor, from 250 to just 30 people. A reminder to read the fine print. A popular Instagram account goes dark after local artists were hit with copyright infringement notices. And we meet a rower smashing records. She recently arrived in Hawaii direct from California after braving more than 2,400 miles of open ocean. Plus, we learn why three companies are vying for the right to fly to Lanai. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Robbie Dingman, in for Catherine Cruz. Chief elections officers around the country received letters last week from the U.S. Justice Department. Federal officials threatened criminal prosecution of top officials here if they allowed ballots cast by non-citizens to be counted. State Elections Chief Scott Nago also testified before lawmakers last week, who pressed him on what would happen if the U.S. Postal Service refused to deliver mail-in ballots. President Donald Trump's earlier executive order that sought to limit the USPS has been blocked by a federal judge. We spoke with Nago this morning and asked him about those hot seat issues, as well as how overall preparations for the August primary are going.
Hawaii has always been a big absentee mail state, so this is not anything different than we've been doing for years prior to switching to vote by mail, which just now we concentrate on vote by mail. So it's really not a big change from an administration standpoint.
So on to challenges. What about the impact of the letters that were sent to you and other state elections officials across the country threatening prosecution if non-citizens are allowed to vote?
You know, it's not going to deter us from doing our mission, which is providing secure, accessible, and convenient elections. That's what where our mission is to do, and that's what we're going to continue to do. We'll answer the letters, but it's not going to deter us from carrying out our mission.
And it's not going to change what you do?
No, it's not going to change what we do, because non-citizens aren't allowed to vote anyway.
So lawmakers also asked you last week about your plan B if the U.S. Post Office refuses to deliver ballots per President Trump's earlier directive. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so my understanding is that earlier directive was enjoined in court, so the USPS can't do that. I was asked a hypothetical question whether or not what would happen if mail ballots or if the USPS refused to deliver the mail. Like I said then, if that's a hypothetical question, we have a lot of things that we would need to. There are a lot of other issues that we would have to have plan Bs for. So delivering mail is very unlikely to happen. So that is not something that we would focus our efforts on or have focused our efforts on coming up with a plan B. That's why we don't have one.
Sure. But if I know you to be a very careful person who looks into a lot of things. So if it on the unlikely event that it did happen, you have some thoughts on it.
So basically we'd be one jurisdiction that would be impacted. There'd be other jurisdictions. So we would monitor what other states are doing. I'm sure other states would have to also do the same thing, whether it be opening up more in-person voting or finding another way to deliver the ballots, or like I said, even suing the USPS to deliver the mail. It's just, there's a lot of different options on the table to have an actual plan B. That's just, like I said, we have a lot of other things that we need to concentrate on, and this one is really low on the priority list.
What's being done to address the potential of long lines on election day for those who do want to vote in person?
Yeah, and like I said, if you're going to vote in person, do two things, and it's not for you, it's for the people behind you in line. Make sure you check your voter registration and make sure it's current, because if it's not current, you'd be asked to do some things which would impact the lines. Also, we have a digital voter guide on our website at elections.hawaii.gov that voters should go to, so that when they see their ballot, it's not the first time they're seeing the candidate names for the first time, and they can read up on the candidates so they can kind of have an idea of who they want to vote for.
Well, full disclosure for me, as you know, since 2020, I've been a volunteer elections observer, and we test and monitor the vote counting system, the handling of ballots, watch you folks at the counting center and how you store the ballots. I came in as a media observer, and they're independent volunteers from other areas. Do you want to chat briefly about what role the observers play?
Sure. The official observers actually serve as the eyes and ears of the general public. They're the ones that provide the transparency, and they're watching the process for the public, because you can't get the entire public in there. So you have official observers which serve as the eyes and ears to make sure that everything is going proper.
Do you need any more volunteers for the primary or general elections?
You know, we can always use more volunteers for the official observers or workers. I mean, if you want to volunteer for the elections, call our office 888-453-8683 or go to our website, elections.hawaii.gov.
When you talk a little bit about people showing up at the polls, as we've seen in recent years, and not having seen the ballot or not necessarily being registered, it's easier than usual, or that it used to be, to register and to vote ahead of time in person. Can you explain a little bit about what are the other opportunities in addition to Election Day where people could vote at a machine?
So in-person voting, when we're in a polling place, the model is limited just to Election Day. When we're in a vote-by-mail model, we have what we call voter service centers, where in-person voting actually starts 10 days prior to Election Day and runs up until Election Day. So voters can actually vote in person at a machine up to 10 days prior to the election.
And those voter service centers are across the state or only on Oahu?
No, they're across the state, and it depends on which county you're in. But for a list of voter service centers near you, go to our website, elections.hawaii.gov, as well as for a list of drop boxes where you can drop off your voted mail ballot.
And as I understand it from the counties, the drop boxes have been dropped for Honolulu County?
Yeah, they'll be opening when ballots hit home. So they'll be open when you get your ballot and you vote it, the drop boxes will be open.
In general, in the past, when there's been a lack of a presidential election, there's also been a drop in voter interest. Are you seeing that this year?
It's hard to say because we really haven't seen the ballots returned yet because they haven't gone off. But historically, non-presidential elections, there has been a dip in turnout compared to presidential elections.
Yeah, I'm sorry. What I meant is there a drop in registration this year?
No, registration always seems to go up every year. So you really can't use the registration count. It's really easy to register. You can do it online. You can do it when you need your driver's license. You can fill out an application. All you have to do is fill it out, turn it in, mail it to the county clerk's office.
And it's going to get even easier to be registered going forward, as I understand it.
So when you renew your driver's license or when you apply for your driver's license, you'll automatically be registered if you attest to the three following things. You're a U.S. citizen, you're a resident of Hawaii, and you're at least 18 years of age.
What else is different? What is different this year?
So the registration deadline changed. However, if you do miss that deadline, you can always register and vote in person at a voter service center.
Yeah, that's why I know I always am a little challenged about how to phrase the registration deadline, since you can still register in person.
Yeah, so the registration deadline is July 29th to register to receive your ballot in the mail. Otherwise, you would have to go and register and vote in person.
And that's for the August 8th primary election?
Correct.
And then, of course, there are a new set of deadlines for the general election.
Yes.
I think that's most of what I wanted to cover. Anything else that, what do you want to let our listeners know?
That they'll be receiving their ballot in the mail by July 21st. If they don't receive it, they should contact their clerk's office. When you do vote and you do make a mistake, do not cross it out or use whiteout. There is a phone number or a website in the instructions to request a replacement ballot. And finally, go to elections.hawaii.gov to get to look at our digital voter guide, which will let you know about the candidates and contests on your ballot.
Right. And to emphasize, you can pull up your actual ballot.
Correct.
What it will look like.
Yeah. So if you type in your address, it'll give you the ballot you have, and it'll give you the contest. So you don't have to look up your contest. It will actually let you see the contest that will be on your ballot.
We've been hearing from Chief Elections Officer Scott Nago. Find those sample ballots, key dates, and deadlines for the upcoming primary election at elections.hawaii.gov.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering a Master of Accounting program. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
In India, the caste system began many centuries ago and was tied to religion. Since then, it's evolved.
Today, it continues, but in a very secular, globalized capitalist context.
We explore how caste plays out in the Indian diaspora and learn about its connection to Black liberation in the United States. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ferraro Choi, architects dedicated to creating learning environments across Hawaii's educational institutions. FerraroChoi.com.
It's been nearly a decade since more than 250 homeless people created an encampment near the Waianae Small Boat Harbor. The village drew complaints, but also gained attention as it grew a sense of community. Honolulu Star Advertiser reporter Dan Nakaso has the latest and front page story in today's paper. Dan has been following this story for years and joins us now to fill us in. Dan, my friend, thanks for making time today.
Absolutely. Anytime.
So what's the latest?
Well, the residents of Pu'u, Honua, or Waianae are getting ready to make the final move to the Mauka location that they purchased by generating $12 million in donations. And they've been given until October 16th to get the final 30 people out and relocate them to this spot that already has 140 former residents of the boat harbor. There are still a small group that aren't going to move. They've been given notice that they need to be out. So I'm updating that, and we'll see what happens next. And the people that are left behind in the boat harbor, I vowed to bring it back to the way it was before they began moving in.
To refresh our listeners, maybe tell us a little bit about what was so different about this community. First off, just start with $12 million of fundraising from a homeless community. Tell us how that happened.
Yeah. So Twinkle Borge, who was the founder and matriarch of the situation out there, had pretty strict rules about how to behave. No fighting, no substance abuse, that kind of thing, and to be respectful. And that was different in the explosion of encampments we've seen over the years. And, the final punishment was to get forced out. But a lot of people came and went. And as you mentioned, there was a lot of concern about any potential damage, and of course anything criminal got blamed on them, and so they really tried to run a tight ship. She has since passed 2 years ago, and they're vowing to keep those policies in place in the Mauka site.
And how is that Mauka site? How is it? How is it developed? I mean, I saw the pictures in the paper. Just describe it for people who haven't seen those photos.
Yeah, it's impressive. It's they've got paved roads and and structures that have communal bathrooms, communal kitchens. They're even developing their own produce at an ag operation. And they've got, they raised a lot of money for infrastructure, and they bought different styles of homes. They're just waiting on the last 30 to arrive from China. The prices have been all over the map, depending on the design and where they came from a low of 10,000 to as high as 75,000 initially. And they've been changing models to adapt to pricing and that sort of thing. But yeah, it's they're going to have lockable homes, and all the residents have to do is pay for the utilities. Dynamic Community Solutions, which is the nonprofit that Twinkle formed and now run by James Kelly, they're using the same kind of rules that they had at the Boat Harbor, and to create a nice community. They have walkable homes, but they're all going to be fenced in, and everybody's encouraged to work together as a community, and it's a lot of kids, Kapuna as well, and it's pretty innovative what they're doing.
Yeah, the joke is strong fences make the best neighbors, right? But this has been an amazing story. I mean, do you see other people being able to do this, to copy this, to replicate it, to take it to another community?
Right. So there may be smaller efforts underway, but this is by far the biggest. And it is, of the many models we have of trying to address homelessness, this one really generated a lot of interest, partly because former Mayor Kirk Caldwell, who was mayor when it was a problem, has done significant fundraising on their behalf. And, Governor Ige back in 2018 was under pressure to sweep it, but that would have just created, sent 250 homeless people scattered around Waianae, which was not going to solve any problems. So they've gotten a lot of support, and support from the government, and support from state and county government, support from Senator Schatz. They've won over a lot of people, and I think the proof is in the progress they've made out there. There's Auntie Blanche and Waimanalo's getting help from Dwayne Carrizo. So there's lots of different efforts underway.
That's great. That's great, Dan. We appreciate you bringing us good news. Good news on the front page. So thanks for giving us the update, and we'll talk soon.
Anytime, Robbie. Thank you.
Take care. Thanks. We've been.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
This July, experience HPR's Live from the Atherton Classical Concert Series. On July 18th, violinist Yuri Hughes joins pianist Jasmine Nagano for an intimate recital. Then on July 25th, vocalist Kaylin Howard and pianist Brian Bethia take the stage for an evening of classical song and piano. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. This event is sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Oh, Hawaii. Earlier this hour, we heard from Chief Elections Officer Scott Nago. Hawaii residents who are registered to vote for the primary election should expect to receive their ballots in the mail by next week. For today's quiz, we're testing your knowledge of local elections. Here on Oahu, the City and County's Elections Division provides direct voter services, which includes voting by mail, voter service centers, voter registration, and absentee voting. Beginning last week, the office began rolling out drop boxes to 17 sites across Oahu. The city is responsible for island-wide voter logistics, ensuring each citizen has access to a ballot, no matter what physical barriers or language barriers they may be. To do that, election materials are translated into a number of languages. For today's quiz, we want to know, how many languages are election materials available in for the state of Hawaii? Price is Right rules, closest to the answer without going over wins. Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
Copyright woes have hit some local businesses on social media in recent months. One locally popular Instagram account with 350,000 followers was taken down in the mix, which account owners say is unfair. The issue might be in the fine print. Joining us with more is HPR's culture and arts reporter, Cassie Ordonio. Good morning, Cassie.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Well, you're going to have to sort this out for us a little bit because it's kind of complicated. No one likes to read the fine print, right? But it's important, and you can tell us why.
Exactly. So that popular Instagram account that got their Instagram account revoked was actually Worldwide Walls, which is, you know, a nonprofit organization that was meant to promote local and international artists. And you see it all over Kaka'ako and even at Farrington High with their recent murals project. And so Jasper Wong was basically caught off guard at first why he was getting hit with all of these takedowns, but notice it was coming all from one company.
So I started receiving them, I believe, like late last year, but I didn't think that much into it because I was like, you know, I thought that it'd be good if I just like deleted those posts, but it only dawned on me that it was all coming from one company, like more recently, because I did try to like reach out to Meta themselves and say like, hey, I don't know why we're receiving these copyright infringement notices. If you look at some of the posts that is shared, like the artist writes thank you in it, you know, and also like, you know, what else can we do to sort of deal with this? Then we started getting so many of them that it triggered the shutdown, which happened at the end of April.
So the company that he's talking about is Social Coaster, which is a Tennessee-based company. And that company operates under business names like Be Viral and IP Shield. And Be Viral, think about it as a licensing company. And IP Shield is basically their copyright enforcement division. And so I didn't realize that this company actually has been around for a while, since 2014, and it was founded by Tennessee-based Jonathan Burden. And this licensing company, what they do is they help promote content creators, but they also offer services by monitoring the internet to make sure their clients' videos are not being shared without their permission. And that happens a lot on YouTube, for example, where content creators will rip off other content creators' work and then monetize off of it, meaning that they get money without you know, taking their work without their permission. And that's what the copyright laws are for. And so this company kind of makes sure that, you know, their content creators, which they have 65,000 content creators with them, making sure their content doesn't get ripped off. But one Hawaii-based artist had signed a contract with Be Viral. And, you know, their conversations go back to 2023, and that's through screenshots that this artist has shared with me through my reporting. That artist is Terrell Porter. He's actually well-known locally for his hyper-realistic murals. He's known for painting murals of Kobe Bryant, Max Holloway recently, and even Fiji and Kaimuki. So his work is pretty well-known. But he was originally reached out to on social media, and, you know, he was under the impression that, you know, the company representatives were asking for his permission to share his videos on their platform. So he was giving a submission form, but within the submission form were terms and agreements with a digital signature and like a small fine print. But now other businesses that Porter works for or works with are getting hit with these copyright infringement notices and takedown notices, even though he gave them verbal permission to use his content. And all of these conversations between Porter and BeViral were on Instagram.
I was under the impression that I was giving them the rights to use the video for promoting my artwork on their pages. I didn't think it was like an intel of like anything completely exclusive, because I mean, because I still have the rights to the video, so I get to say who else has rights to the video. But I didn't read that anywhere whether they were given like any type of exclusive only them and only me type of anything. What you see is what I gave you.
So what can he do now?
So for Terrell Porter, as of Thursday, he's been in contact with BeViral to get out of his contract, but is still getting the issue resolved because, you know, we see that most of these accounts are operated by artificial intelligence and you don't really actually talk to a real person, or it's like an automated response. So he's still waiting for it. And he said it's a very frustrating process. But for Worldwide Walls, I mean, their Instagram account is still deleted. And so with talking to Jasper Wong, he was in conversation with Meta, which Meta was the one who actually deleted their Instagram account. And Meta was told that, you know, what they're doing is legal because Worldwide Walls was hit so many by copyright infringement. Jasper Wong said that he had about 4 to 5 copyright infringement notices, and then that he would be charged $1,000 to lift it. So, you know, it's harder for artists to get promotions, but the founder, Jonathan Burden, said that what may look like free promotion can also divert views and revenues away from the creator and reduce the value of the original legitimate licenses. And when I spoke to copyright lawyer Bill Meyer, he said these kinds of companies have existed for years. But the bottom line is, if you sign the contract, you sign the contract.
If you came up with enough cases or instances where, you know, artists would come in, hey, you know, they told me this, but the contract said that, you get enough of those people, you might be able to show a what's known as a course of conduct or a behavior where, you know, everybody could maybe come together and file a class action or something like that. But the basic law is, if you sign a contract, we're going to assume you read it and you understood it. And so, yeah, people get totally embarrassed. And frankly, lots of local artists don't have the resources to hire counsel because everything is kind of on a small scale, right?
Be careful what you sign. That was HBR's Cassie Ordonio. Find her coverage at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thanks, Cassie.
Thank you.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
Cape Verde, Haiti, and Curaçao, just to name a few, have captivated soccer fans in this year's World Cup, even though they were the longest of long shots to win.
People like success. The underdogs, by definition, should not be successful. What gravitates people towards the underdog?
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating nearly 90 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com. Thank you.
Now it's time to reveal the answer to today's quiz. Earlier, we talked to the state elections chief. Ballot drop boxes have been rolling out, and voter service centers will come online later this month for the upcoming primary elections. We asked you to guess the number of languages that election materials are available in for the state of Hawaii. Like many other states, Hawaii offers ballots in languages that include Japanese, Spanish, and Chinese. Reflecting our diverse community, ballots are also printed in Pacific Island languages, including, of course, Olelo Hawaii, Samoan, and Marshallese. According to the Center for Civic Design, translated ballots can be a bridge to fuller participation in American democracy. Translation can give first-time voters confidence that they're filling out their ballot correctly. And the total number of languages we were looking for? 17. And the closest guess we got was from Sugi. You can find a complete list of languages online at the Honolulu Elections Division website in their Language Assistance Portal. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Days, 17 hours, and 55 minutes. That's how long it took 31-year-old Kelsey Fendler to row solo from Monterey, California to Honolulu. Fendler broke both the women's and the men's record for the trek, documenting every day of her journey through social media, especially on TikTok, where she now has almost 2 million followers. Hundreds gathered along Magic Island in the Alawai Boat Harbor earlier this month to watch her complete the record-breaking journey. Fendler sat down with HPR's Tori Desjardins and spoke about the support she received from around the globe.
I just feel so much gratitude for what had happened and what I was able to do and kind of still processing the whole thing. That I didn't go into it thinking that I was even in the running to be able to get the men's record. I was going for the women's world record, so I had no concept that that was possible for me. And I didn't really let myself even entertain the idea until like a couple weeks out when I realized, like, I'd done the math and I knew that I was hitting the right numbers to get close to it, but I didn't let myself kind of accept it until a couple weeks out when I knew I was almost 500 miles ahead of the men's record. And then I kind of let myself say, okay, well, maybe this might happen for me. So I think I'm still just kind of accepting it. And there's just a huge piece of gratitude towards how everything went for myself, and then just like all the people that helped me get to this point. I think there's just a lot of gratitude towards everyone and everything that's happened.
Speaking of that gratitude, I mean, you posted all of your entire journey on social media and it got tons and tons of support, and you had so many people on the shoreline along the Alawai like welcoming you in. Could you paint the picture for me and tell me like how that felt going from being so isolated out in the ocean to like all of these people?
Mm-hmm. It was really intense for me because, so that day was really intense. That whole last day was really intense. I got up at like 2 a.m. to like start my day to row in, and I'd been rowing since 2 a.m. and I knew that it was gonna be maybe my last day or I was gonna get in like really early the next morning. So I just wanted to keep pushing really, really hard. The night before, I was able to see Molokai, like just a little glimpse of Molokai as the sun was setting. And I was like, oh my goodness, there it is. And like, I knew that the next day I was going to be able to see Oahu. But the row in was actually really intense for me. So the Molokai channel is really pushy and can be kind of notorious. And I knew I had to like hype myself up to like get in there. And when I was getting near what's called like the China Wall, where like a lot of that ocean swell from the offshore is like hitting that wall, it was actually really, really intense for like a couple hours, like huge waves and also just extremely pushy. So I like got myself past this like very specific waypoint that my router had given me. And he's like, you gotta hit this like dead on, or you're either going to get pushed too far out into the channel or get sucked up above the island. So it's like, you must be like right on top of this waypoint. So the whole time I was like getting pushed around and I was like trying to adjust, and it was like a really hard navigational piece of it all. It was just getting to that waypoint, and it was like 500 yards off of the China Wall. I got past the wall and then through the channel, like coming into Oahu, like the current was so strong and the wind was like 20 to 22 knots. So I was just going so fast. Like I thought I was going to have like 4 hours after I got past the China wall to like get to the harbor. And everyone thought I was going to get there at like 2 a.m. So I didn't really have any time to like be like, oh my goodness, now I'm going to get there in an hour and a half instead of 4 hours. So I know my team was like scrambling to get everything ready. And I was just like, oh my goodness, I don't have any time to get myself kind of prepared for any of this. It all was like this building to like a crescendo of just like the finish where it was just all so intense because it went from me not seeing anyone for so long and being completely isolated in myself to just all of these people and all of this stuff happening so fast and like the reactivity to it. That when I like finally got to the Alawai channel and like all those people were like chanting, I there's probably a video of just my face. I think I had like the million mile stare and just like my eyes were so wide and I was like, I don't know what to do right now.
You're like, I haven't seen people in like over mm-hmm. a month.
Yeah, like getting into the yacht club, I got so overwhelmed because so many people, I just like hid in a storage closet for a while.
Really?
I did. Some of my family and friends were like also in the closet. There was like a little storage room, but they were just like, we're just going to put you in here because this is too much for you right now. And mm-hmm. I just like hid there for a while because I was like, I need a moment, please.
What thoughts were running through your mind when you were in that storage closet?
I actually, so my team that rode with me in 2024 were all there. And I had a conversation with my friend and teammate, Chris, before I did this. And I had actually, I knew that I was going to feel overwhelmed coming in. And we kind of talked about like what we wanted the landing to be like. And it wasn't this. But I knew that sometimes people really want to hear about your experience instantly. And it's really hard to condense it and talk about it. So I was like, I want to go around and just talk about what everyone else has done in the last month and a half. And I just want to hear everyone else's stories. So I had some of my close people around me and I was like, just tell me what you've done for the last month and a half, please tell me stories. And they just all told me funny stories about from their life. And it was kind of grounding because it's like, you know, people I love and care about and haven't gotten to connect with. So I just got to sit there and hear about them. And that was really nice because it kind of just took me out of my own head and my own body. And I got to like really hear what they had to say and what they got to do. So that was really nice for me and really helpful to get myself like backed to being okay.
You said it took you 2 years to prep for this.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of what went into the preparation process? And you did this before with other people.
Correct.
So what influenced you to tackle it alone?
I did do this in 2024 with my team, Hurricane Rowing. It was a really awesome experience for me, but it was definitely a learning experience. I was shooting from the hip for a lot of the stuff, like figuring it out. We were definitely just like a bunch of broke 30-year-old women trying to make something happen. So like we stood outside of Walmart's and did like a table and tried to fundraise and all this stuff. Like we didn't have like these any like huge resources, but we learned a lot about like outreach and just trying to make dreams happen. We did a lot of just labor for the love of it. So we had a great row. It was a great experience. I learned so many things about the boats. I look at that row as just kind of like this huge stepping stone. That was the reason I was so successful in this row. Mm-hmm. So I came directly off of that row knowing that I wanted to do another row. There was a moment in the middle of that row where I realized that we were already halfway done. And I knew that I was closer to the finish than the start. And I was devastated that it was going to be over soon. And then I was like, if I'm never back in this place again, in this space and offshore in a tiny boat like this, I don't know how I could handle that. And I knew I wanted to be in that space again, but I didn't know what that was going to look like. So I stepped off the boat knowing I was going to do another row.
You talk about the space that you were in mm-hmm. during the row. Can you kind of go more into depth about like what that space is like for you and why you love that space so much?
I've always loved the backcountry. I'm a Grand Canyon River guide. I have always looked for a way to be in a boat in the middle of nowhere. It is something that is so core to what I love. And I'm always trying to figure out how to do that in different ways. I've always been really attracted to water, really attracted to boats. And I think ocean rowing uniquely combines things that I love, which is like big water and also rowing and the ocean and just all of these things. And like, it's the biggest piece of wilderness that we have, honestly, is the open ocean. There's nothing more remote and vast than than that. So there's always been this like really deep attraction for me to be in those spaces, and like the humbling nature of being in a space that is so much more powerful than you, and then you get the privilege of being there and just existing in it while trying to work with it, but also the recognition that you are not in control mm-hmm. in that situation is, I love that. I think it's really special. And you don't always get that in your normal life, because we all try to pretend like we're in control of everything that's going on for us, when in reality we're not. But it's a really good thing to try to, for me at least, to seek out places that remind you that you're not in control, and mm-hmm. to be comfortable with that.
Your journey did gain lots of traction on social media, especially TikTok. You have almost 2 million followers. During your route, were you aware like how many eyes were on you and how much support you really had?
No. And for reference, I still don't really understand what 2 million followers really means in the world of social media. Someone told me that, and then I was like, okay, how many people live in the United States? And I like started to like do some math, and I was like, well, it's not that many. Like, I don't have a great concept of what that actually means. And especially when I was rowing, I had no idea. Yeah. I mean, I had a Starlink, but I wasn't doing my own social media. I was recording videos, and then I was sending them to my teammate, Jen, that rode with me in 2024, and she was like putting them together for me and putting them out there. So I wasn't spending time doing social media. I was recording stuff that I thought was interesting, and then Jen would like put it together and then put it out into the world. I didn't know what was going on most of the time. I would turn the Starlink on for like 20 minutes a day, and that was it. I would check the weather and send videos. And then the rest of the time I was just rowing, listening to audiobooks.
How did you know that you wanted to put this on social media in the first place? Like, what influenced you to do that?
Well, there's so much there for that. The reason I am an ocean rower is because of other women that rowed the Pacific. So the Lat 35 team that rowed from California to Big Island, they set the women's four record. And I was like, wow, you guys are amazing. This is so cool. I love rowing because I'm into whitewater. And I just started trying to like explore it from there. And I knew of ocean rowing, but that was kind of like the final straw to like seeing what they did that like pushed me to do my first row. And then after my first row, just watching other people, this is such a small community, ocean rowing is, and watching other people's rows has been such a joy in my life. Like this last winter, my team and a couple other women that are ocean rowers, we all created like a fantasy fleet to watch the Atlantic race. And like, we'll just like text each other about it and be like, oh my God, did you see this? So like, it really, I just wanted to do it as like a gift to the ocean rowing community, because like everyone just like lives vicariously through everyone else's rows, because like it's very rare for people to do more than one ocean row, because it's so much work to get everything together. So there's a lot of people out there that do one ocean row, and then you just forever watch everyone else's and think about your experience. So like it was more for the tiny community of people that have actually done an ocean row, and like my family, I guess. So I was just trying to give it to them because I've watched other people's stuff and loved it and like reveled in their experience along with them. So like I knew that's what I wanted to do just for them.
You said you watched someone else row and you were like, I want to do that. I guess for the people listening, what is some advice or like words of affirmation that you would give to them?
If you really want it, it will take you time, because it takes a lot of time to get the money and to get the resources and to get the training, but everything worth your time and everything good takes a lot of time and a lot of work. Anything special that you're going to do with your time will take effort, but it's so worth it in the end to know that you committed yourself to a goal and saw it through. And like the feeling of, and the process is almost bigger than the actual row itself, is like getting yourself to the point of where you're ready to do something like that, I think is so valuable. But I mean, anyone's capable of doing their own big, hard, scary thing. And if it's ocean rowing, there are so many resources to get into ocean rowing if you have the drive to commit yourself to it, because it's not something that you can just do in a short period of time. Most people, it takes at least 2 years to be ready for something like that. So that is the shortest amount of time you should expect to be able to like pull it off in prep. But that's how you show respect to how big the thing is too. Like doing it in a shorter amount of time usually means you're not ready.
That was American rower Kelsey Fendler talking with HPR's Tori DeJournay. Fendler also shared that audiobooks like Shark Dialogues by Kiana Davenport kept her mind occupied during that long voyage. A contract to subsidize air service to Lanai expires later this year, and three airlines are vying for the right to fly there. Joining us with more on this story is HPR's Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluet-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Robbie.
So that's pretty interesting. I mean, you hear about all kinds of remoteness on the neighbor islands, but here three companies think this is worth jumping into. Can you kind of give us a little bit of the background of who's flying there now and why this?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now, the U.S. Department of Transportation is reviewing these three proposals and deciding between them. So the three airlines that are competing for this subsidy are Mokulele Airlines, which is the current contract holder for the Lanai route, as well as Pacific Air Charters, which is based in Honolulu, and Cape Air, which is a Massachusetts-based company. So to rewind a little bit, the Essential Air Service is a federal program that was designed to ensure that remote rural communities like Molokai and Lanai have access to larger transportation hubs. So it was established in 1978, and both Lanai and Molokai are actually both eligible for Essential Air Service. But both airports had previously been served by unsubsidized service. So in other words, they weren't receiving, airlines that were flying there weren't receiving funding from the federal government, but they were meeting these essential air requirements of how many flights they had to offer and how many seats. There are certain requirements that are on essential air service eligible airports. And so Mokulele had been serving Lanai up until the end of 2023, and that's when the airline wrote a letter to the U.S. Department of Transportation saying, hey, we can't afford to fly there any longer without a subsidy. They basically said that it wasn't a profitable route for them, and they were no longer able to fly it unless they got some financial assistance. And so that's what triggered, in 2024, the Department of Transportation to put out a request for proposals. And Mokulele applied, as well as Pacific Air Charters, and Mokulele was awarded a two-year contract. And so that is what is expiring this year, and they're sort of starting that process over again to review the service and select an airline for the next 2 to 4 years. So Lanai Air, I will note, does provide service to Lanai, but they don't meet these EAS requirements, and so it doesn't really factor into this process. I did talk with Maui County Council Member Gabe Johnson, who is from Lanai, and he just talked about how important reliability and affordability are for his community, and those are really key factors in the comments that residents did submit in favoring one airline or another. You know, many residents have felt like in the past Mokulele hasn't had a great track record with reliability, but I talked with Louis St. Cyr, who took the lead as president of Mokulele's parent company, Surf Air Mobility, about 2 years ago. And he talks about some of the company's improvements and changes they've made since then.
The first thing that we said is that we were going to invest and improve our service. We've invested over $22 million. One example is we have five new planes. We have a sixth plane coming to Hawaii next month. When you look at our performance right now, our completion rate, actually month to date, it's 99% completion. Last month, it was 98. We operate, you know, roughly 107, 109 flights a day. And about 38 of those flights are EAS and the rest are non-EAS. So we have a really nice blend in Hawaii between the EAS flights and what we just run on a regular scheduled flight. And that's really important because from a commercial perspective, from a stability perspective, we are, you know, we're in solid shape in Hawaii. You know, we have 16 airplanes in Hawaii. When it comes to our fares, our fares are very competitive in Hawaii, and you've seen our philosophy on fares. We've been very clear about that. We average about $110, and we've got a lot of different fare segments. That gives either people from Honolulu wanting to go to Lanai or the Lanai community flexibility with the fares. So that's one clear benefit. From a weekly trips perspective, you know, we're looking at a combination of 63 flights per week, which is pretty substantial. This is going to Maui and going to Honolulu. Our bid is very competitive.
So you mentioned that Mokulele also has EAS contracts to fly to Kalaupapa, Hana, and Kamuala. Over the last 2 years, has their reputation changed?
You know, I think in the community it has gotten a little bit better, but people do have, you know, a memory of that historic, you know, what they consider lack of reliability. And so I do think that that still is a factor in the perception. Now, Cape Air is another airline. They're based in Massachusetts. They are competing for this. They have experience also flying essential air routes. They have about 12 communities that they serve currently in that capacity, as well as a lot of other routes. And Chief Operating Officer Andrew Bonney was on Lanai'i last week talking with community members there about their needs, and here's what he says.
Cape Air has been very fortunate to do lots of island service in the past, and this is kind of what Cape Air is all about. We've been fortunate to serve remote destinations since we started service in 1989, and we started, that was between Provincetown, Massachusetts and Boston, and then we started in the Caribbean flying island service in 1998. And have been there now almost 30 years. Cape Air also served for 15 years out in Micronesia, flying between Guam, Rota, and Saipan on behalf of First Continental and then United. So Pacific Islands are very close to our heart, and we're delighted to be here talking with the people in Lanai'i about air service here. Cape Air has proposed 6 daily round trips between Lanai'i and Honolulu and 3 daily round trips between Lanai'i and Maui. So a total of 9 daily round trips. Cape Air has a total of 97 aircraft in our fleet. We're the largest commuter airline in the world. All of our aircraft, including the ones that we're proposing service here in Hawaii, are 9-seat aircraft. When we were here starting, 2 years ago, talking with the community about air service, the number one thing that they impressed upon us was the importance of reliability. So while the schedule could probably be flown with 2 aircraft, we will bring at least 5 out to the Hawaiian Islands to ensure that we have the ability to always be reliable.
So the community must be pretty happy to hear someone else making a strong bid.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, Pacific Air Charters, I spoke with President Marshall Ashley about his company. You know, he didn't want to be, didn't feel comfortable being recorded, but he was happy to talk about it. They have operated mostly as a charter service for their 20-plus year history as a company. They also applied for the last round of Lanai'i EAS, but they didn't have some of the FAA requirements for it. Now they do. They've been granted commuter authority, so they're kind of ready to push into that field. And they're also proposing 6 daily round trips between Lanai'i and Honolulu and 3 between Lanai'i and Maui. So lots to consider. The contract is scheduled to start on December 1st, so the U.S. Department of Transportation has a few months to figure out who is going to be getting this contract.
So we'll be hearing more about this from you for sure.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That was HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. You can read all of her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for today. Tomorrow, we learn about one of the wide-ranging impacts of the recent Kona low storms. Notice anything different about our mango season? Got mangoes on the mind? Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. Did you know you can find The Conversation as a podcast? Head to our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Robbie Dingman, in for Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.